Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is former state legislator and now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas, Jeannie Ives. Jeannie, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate thanks it. For having me on.
So we begin this morning with a story we're going to talk about quite a bit this morning, because later in the show we're going to have both former federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy on, as well as AmericanGreatness.com's Julie Kelly, who's been covering this with a level of detail no one else in the country has to this point, talking about the news on Friday in the federal government's case against these Michigan militia members, those who were alleged to have plotted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, the Eva Perón of East Lansing, and put her on trial, in quotation marks, for treason, mainly associated with her COVID policies. Well, what was the jury verdict on Friday? As you've probably heard by now, two acquittals, full acquittals of two of the four on trial. And the other two, hung jury, federal government says they're going to retry those two. And the question we're revisiting again, given this federal government failure, should the FBI continue to exist in its current form? Because I got to tell you, Jeannie, over the last 20 years, as we've gone from Richard Jewell to the anthrax case, to the botching of the investigation into that predator doctor that molested so many Olympic gymnasts, Nasser, to the last 4 years of a law enforcement agency completely politicized to serve the interests of the Beltway establishment at the expense of, number one, the truth, and in the manifestation of that is targeting a political campaign on behalf of another political campaign. And, of course, I'm talking about Russian collusion and the FBI's performance during the Trump years. And now this. After that, I got to tell you, my support for the FBI in its current form is now exhausted. And I don't think the FBI can or should continue to exist in its current form. I believe the agency has shown itself, like so many institutions in the federal government, as incapable of reform from within. And this is something that Republicans should take up if they are able to gain control of Congress in 22 and the presidency in 24. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Take your calls on this. Jeannie, what say you?
Well, listen, I have personal people that I personally know people that work for the FBI. And while we all say we want to support the rank and file, it's just like, hey, but I've got some great teachers in the educational institution. Yeah, but your institutions are corrupt. And so where are those rank and file agents speaking up about the leadership of their own agencies? That's confusing to me.
Yeah, we talked to several of them on this show fairly routinely. Kevin Brock, former assistant director of counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. James Fitzgerald, who is the FBI profiler who brought the Unabomber to justice. And, you know, they're retired, so they can speak freely. But you're right. I mean, in terms of any sort of evidence that there is real pressure from below on Christopher Wray and the senior leadership or prior to Ray, Comey and the senior leadership, as corrupt as that senior leadership team was, there's really no evidence of it. I know Christopher Wray made a big splash about the reforms that he was going to institute when he took over from Comey after that ugly Russian collusion affair and the FBI's role in perpetuating that fraud. But again, where's the evidence of that? And if anything, rather than any sort of self-reflection or evidence of institutional change, you see them doubling down with Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray obsessing about white supremacism and this being, you know, an existential threat to our country. And the evidence they used to support that claim, in part, was this Whitmer kidnapping plot, which a jury essentially found to be a case of FBI entrapment. There were like two dozen people involved in this conspiracy to abduct the governor of Michigan, and half of them were FBI agents.
Well, that's what's concerning. So you're not talking about one or two agents that were told, why don't you go find out what these people are actually saying, listen in on their conversations, report back, see if it goes any further. That's not what happened. You had a dozen. That's what was shocking to me, too. It wasn't one or two FBI agents. It was a dozen of them colluding together to have this, to basically, you know, talk these people in to some conversations that actually never ended up getting, you know, carried out. But I find it remarkable. And honestly, do these guys not get training on entrapment and what it means? And if they do get training, then they also need to be held accountable as well, the individual agents. Because if it were reversed, if this were something that were going on in the military and you had a violation of the Geneva Convention, you know, you'd have the captain at the lowest level up on charges.
How about at the local police level?
Yeah.
If you had individual rank and file officers, you know, violating people's rights, I mean, they get individually held accountable. It's not some sort of like institute. We're going to have hearings and we're going to talk about institutional change. No, you have individual police officers that are held accountable for violating a suspect's rights. The other thing, too, is that just in terms of the details of the government's case, I mean, they had two of the so-called conspirators in this kidnapping who pled out and testified against the other four, and still the jury came back and acquitted two of the four, hung on the other two.
Yeah.
You know, and I assume those two, you say, well, there you go, Dan, that's evidence that there was this nefarious plot. Look, number one, those two probably pled out because they felt that
they'd get a better deal and they didn't.
They'd get a better deal.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was a risk assessment on their part.
Sure. And the other thing is, yeah, you know, these look, if I was in a group with 24 guys and they said, I got an idea, let's go kidnap the governor of Michigan and hold her on trial for treason because of her lockdown policies, I would say, no, thank you. I'm not a moron and we're not going to violate the law. I don't care who's encouraging me to do it. But that's separate and distinct from the FBI goading people from, you know, conspiracy theories and idiotic talk over beers to actually moving in furtherance of this sort of criminal activity. This is why we have, you know, laws against entrapment. So, you know, the whole thing is just terribly problematic. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, Bob, Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, I think the problem with the FBI is just they're too powerful. And I mean, they have been since J. Edgar Hoover. This is not something I think that's, I don't think this is a new occurrence with the FBI. I think it's always been there. The potential, I mean, Hoover was blackmailing people. And Dan, you brought up a couple cases that they really screwed the pooch on. But don't forget either the Whitey Bulger and Greg Scarpa. I mean, look into those cases.
Yeah.
What these people were allowed to get away with because of their handlers in the FBI. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Bob. And here's the thing. Somebody could say, well, Dan, so this is, or Jeannie, this is the same conversation we have about police, Chicago police, institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
And so why do you dismiss institutional racism when we talk about big city police departments or not so bit such big city police departments, but you're talking about institutional failure here. Well, I'll tell you why. Is because, I mean, just because I know somebody on the left would bring that up, there is a difference here. You know, maybe once upon a time in the era of Bull Connor, you can make that argument. But I think it's pretty clear that, for example, big city police departments where that are usually the focus of these charges of institutional racism and the need for institutional reform or outright defunding, they're controlled by Democrats, and they have been for a long time.
Well,
and
they're controlled by blacks, too. So, well, right. I mean, there's no racism, sorry.
But I mean, black or white, it's all one philosophy.
I agree.
And their appointees to things like police chief are, you know, from their ideological disposition or perhaps even their partisan affiliation. And so, you know, the leadership of the Chicago Police Department, for example, tough to make out the case that they're perpetuators of institutional racism. And so you can deal at the street level with individual bad actors. And I would say the same thing at the FBI if there was evidence of that. But the evidence of that at the FBI based on performance is exactly the opposite. It's what you were saying. You know, people at the rank and file level, you have people that don't want to participate in the politicization of the agency. But at the hierarchical level, combined with the Department of Justice, you have precisely that.
Well, and it's hard to believe that other agents didn't know what was going on and, again, still said nothing and allowed this to just get out of hand. So how far up does this go? Is this a regional FBI case? Is this something that was directed from D.C.? I think that there's a lot of investigation that now has to occur, and it should occur. I mean, you want to talk about a special hearing. Let's find out how it happened that a dozen FBI agents were involved in an entrapment case. Yeah, well, right. By the way, ahead of an election.
Well, right. Well, exactly. That's another key point.
The timing's amazing.
Right. It was October of 2020. That's mm-hmm. when this went down. And, oh, by the way, in terms of accountability, you know, to make the case that I'm making with respect to its incapability of being reformed from within. The agent in charge of the Detroit field office, a guy named Stephen D. Antuano, was promoted to the assistant director in charge of the Washington, D.C. field office, where now he oversees the 1-6 investigation.
Yes, and I read his background. I think he's, by background, some sort of really financial wizard. He's a CPA. He's somebody who's probably done a lot more white collar financial crime stuff for the FBI. And now apparently he's going to be handling a lot of other cases that I think he's probably not well equipped for.
Well, you know, and ultimately he was the special agent in charge of the Detroit field office. So mm-hmm. he signed off on this.
Yep.
Well, what the jury essentially decided was an entrapment plot against these militia dudes in Michigan. I mean, problems all around. Jim in Sheboygan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, so I'm in my 60s. I've yet to see a federal agency get eliminated or whatever you want to call it, fixed. I mean, you got the U.S. Postal Service. You have Amtrak. You have the Department of Education. Worse yet, you have EPA and all of their weaponization of environmental laws against businesses, and I just don't see anything happening to the FBI. Now, you talk about January 6th. Yeah, let's investigate that. I mean, if they had all these agents in Michigan, I can only imagine how many agents they had on the January 6th grounds at the time when that happened. So I just don't see anything happening. But and then accountability, even after the Russian hoax, zero accountability.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, former state legislator Jeannie Ives. Now you can find her work through Breakthrough Ideas. And quick plug, Jeannie, coming up May 13th.
Yes.
We got a little confab, me, you, John Cass.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Tickets are going fast. I'm just amazed how many people are excited to see you and John again. Maybe a little bit of a reprisal of the roast.
Yeah.
But really just a discussion about Illinois and will this be the year?
And people can get more information and tickets where?
At breakthrough-ideas.com. That's our website.
All right. So on this installment of Sports and Politics, a little bit of positivity with Scottie Scheffler's victory at the Masters yesterday. But before we get to that, take me out to the ball game. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jill. Cracker Jill. PepsiCo is rolling out Cracker Jill to promote women's sports, so they say. Here's how they said it.
No female had ever won a wrestling state championship in North Carolina until now.
An 11-year-old girl is the first girl in the history of the Arlington Football Association to score a touchdown.
Historic news in the sports world. The first female minor league manager in baseball history.
Uh-huh. And then they feature the pop singer Normani to give you a sample of what you'll be enjoying probably during the seventh inning stretch.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jill. No one can stop you if you have the will. So let's root, root, root for a girl's dream. We're adding our face to the game. And we'll run, throw with never a doubt. It's a new ball game.
I do really like Normani. Yeah, I mean, that Love Lies song that she sings, and it's a great voice. The lyrics, not so much, Jeannie. I'm sorry I can't get on board with Cracker Jill.
But Frito-Lay introduces Cracker Jill to support, celebrate women in sports. This is a news article from Los Angeles. I thought that we weren't supposed to be, you know, identifying women individually. And why not, like, Cracker Jordan? That's androgynous, that name. Could be boy, could be a girl, could be whatever.
Could be next.
I mean, who knows? But to celebrate women in sports, they're not quite woke enough yet.
What is a woman, after all? No one knows.
I don't know.
No one.
Why do they ruin all of my favorite foods?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Is Jeannie Ives being a misogynist by not embracing Cracker Jill? And are we unnecessarily applying the political lens to this innocuous offering of Cracker Jill to celebrate women in sport?
You can't do that anymore. You're not supposed to do that.
Here's the thing about that. Celebrate women in sport. Did you notice the intro was about women or girls playing boy sports? So it's the girl who kicks the extra point on the football team. It's the girl who wins, in quotation marks, a state wrestling championship because boys won't wrestle against her. But I digress. So it's girls crossing over to play boy sports the way that we're supposed to embrace Leah Thomas, for example, crossing over to swim for the girls' team. Does that change your mind at all or inform your opinion as to whether this is really about celebrating girls in sport?
I don't know, but do you know at Wheaton Warrenville South, there was a female wrestler, and she made it to state first ever time. Mm-hmm. But she's also front and center in the show choir, and she's a fantastic dancer, singer. Great, great girl. She's just outstanding. So, you know, sometimes they can compete. They certainly can, obviously. She's a strong athlete. But again, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just wonder what they're doing here.
I suppose there are outliers, and there are particularly in younger ages where, you know, when girls may develop faster, or there's a girl who's just a anomaly when it comes to a particular sport, and she can compete against the boys at least at the grade school or even high school level. But I mean, is that what we're really doing here? Is that what corporate America is doing here?
No, we're selling caramel corn and peanuts, and this gets a lot of advertising.
Yeah, but I mean, but what's the gambit here? So it seems to me that this is a scam, because these are the same corporate cultural Marxists who promote essentially eliminating women's sports by having men compete against women, a la Leah Thomas. And now they're saying we're the guardians of women in sport. But we're not talking about South Carolina beating UConn for the women's national championship. We're talking specifically about young girls competing against young boys in boy sports. I mean, so does that suggest that there is a political agenda here? It's not this just celebration of girls in sport, because girls in sports who can compete on their own merits are few and far between, as we know. So yes, you can hold up the an example or two here and there for however long that lasts, but I mean, the reality is, if you eliminated the gender distinction from sports, you would eliminate 99% of women from participation. Is that not fair?
It's absolutely correct. But, you know, the military started this a long time ago, truthfully. And maybe, you know, Frito-Lay is just catching up now. I mean, they had G.I. Jane back in 1997. Remember that?
Sure. That was Demi Moore.
Yeah.
So when you say the military started this, elaborate.
Well, I mean, I look back to the Ranger School celebratory graduation of the two females that made it through Ranger School and were really pushed through Ranger School. I mean, I got to give it to them, though. They're really tough women. Going through any of that training is extremely difficult. So my hat's off to them. But, to some degree, they were also pushed through. So I don't know. I don't know why we need to go down this thing. Women have been in combat for a long time, but now we have to go full scale, thinking that they're going to pull a 240-pound person out of a foxhole when they can't.
Right.
And it's the same thing here. We can't celebrate women's sports for women's sports. We have to celebrate that they are now competing on the same playing field as the men.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me the is the thing. You have to say something that isn't true rather than just celebrate what is.
Right.
You know, I mean, just sticking on basketball, since I sort of know that past. I mean, Rebecca Lobo is a great female basketball player, one of the greatest female basketball players of all time, certainly at the collegiate level. Why can't you just celebrate her as a great female basketball player? Why does it have to be vis-a-vis men? Or why does it have to be, should Rebecca Lobo, I mean, not that, I'm just using an example, should Rebecca Lobo be playing for the UConn men's team, which is absurd? Why can't it just be in that space? It's the same thing we're talking about with the swimmers. Why can't you celebrate a great swimmer who is a female swimmer? Why does it have to be vis-a-vis Leah Thomas? It just pollutes the entire environment. There are structural differences that make it absurd to attempt this gender-bending combination of sport that is being promoted by these corporate cultural Marxists.
Well,
and I think this Cracker Jill is more of it, and you know Major League Baseball is going to embrace it. Thank God that Harry Caray is not around to have to sing Cracker Jill during the seventh inning.
Well, maybe Frito-Lay will get the Disney treatment and people will just reject it outright. I mean, why do you have to change, a product that's been around and is iconic in America and go down this route? It's just ridiculous. There's other ways to support female athletes. And, you know, Dan, this is apparently the 50th year of Title IX. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it. But in Springfield last week, downstate Democrat Rep. Katie Stewart ran a resolution supporting, you know, celebrating that this is the 50th anniversary of Title IX, which basically introduced women's sports and mandated it as part of an equality measure, which is great. I'm fine. I'm obviously a product of Title IX to some degree. However, she kind of got caught by Blaine Willhauer, a Republican who essentially said, well, then define what a woman is. And Katie Stewart couldn't.
Right.
She
yeah, who knows? Nobody
Brown
knows.
Jackson.
Yeah. Nobody. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows.
No, nobody knows. But she couldn't do it. It's hysterical to listen to.
Well, I mean, and Title IX now is coming full circle. Now Title IX is being used against women by people like Leah Thomas.
Yes.
So, you know, hoist by your own petard. I mean, Title IX, you know, as most identitarian based policies, a lot of unintended consequences, like the elimination of non-revenue boys sports at the collegiate level. Vince in Crete, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Jeannie. I've coached girls softball for over 20 years at the in-house level, travel ball, high school, junior high, and at the end of the season every year, we would always, the other coach and I would always have a guys for boys baseball team versus girls softball team game. And I'll tell you what, we could not cheat enough to keep the boys from just absolutely running at will on the base pads. We had to have them bat left-handed. And my point is that I raised two daughters. One of them even played volleyball at the collegiate level. There is absolutely no comparison between girl athletes and guys.
Thanks for the call, Vince. I mean, you know, it's just, it's something everybody knows, but we live in a time where so many people are afraid to say a simple truth like that. You're a bad person. You're denigrating somebody. I'm not denigrating anybody. You celebrate people in the context in which they achieve, where you have fairness of competition. I mean, why is this, you know, so heretical in some circles? Why? Because they have a political agenda. That's why. Pete in Milwaukee.
Good morning. I agree with the last caller. If we're going to do this with men playing women's sports back and forth, we should make it across the board and let NBA women play against the men, put them on the team. Let baseball players go on men's baseball teams, and it would immediately be eliminated because there's no way they can compete at that level. That's not to put them at all. The Lord has made men and women differently. Put men into a woman's situation and a mother's situation, it would drive them insane because women
That's
have...
not true. That's not true, Pete. Didn't you ever see Three Men and a Baby? I thought Ted Danson, Steve Guttenberg,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Who was the third?
But
yeah. Thanks for the call.
Just,
thanks for the call, Pete. Tony, Downers Grove.
Well, Dan, I think you and Jeannie you summed it up. It's about trying to create a genderless society. That's the agenda. That's what the woke corporations are going to push. And you have enough people on either side of the spectrum that'll just go along with it. You know, it's kind of like celebrating Justice Brown's appointment to the Supreme Court and saying how wonderful it is when, you know, everybody knows she got picked because of her race and her gender. But people are going to celebrate it. And if you say anything against it, mm-hmm. you're going to be on the wrong end. And that's the deal. And you see this now with we've got the NFL. Now you have to incorporate a female on the offensive line coaching. And it's going to go on and on and on. And who knows where it stops.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Dan and Jeannie Ives in for Amy J, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, former state legislator and now principal with Breakthrough Ideas, Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, in case anybody thought Disney would be inhibited at all from their prosecution of DeSantis and the Florida Parents rights legislation, you'd be wrong. They are doubling down, as are their allies in the Biden administration and in the institutional cultural Marxist places as well. Disney releasing this ad that will appear on the Disney Network channels promoting trans families. Amber Biggle is the mom's name, her son Max, and their story.
Do you want to meet a family with a transgender kid? Here we are. Max loves to do backflips. Max loves to play his ukulele. Max loves to just be a kid and just be himself. When I found out I was pregnant, all I really wanted was a happy, healthy, whole child. And that's what I got. If you've never met a transgender child before, what I want you to know is that that child is no different than yours. They have the same hopes and dreams and deserve the same equality as your child does. We tell our kids as often as we can that we love them in as many ways as possible. There are some politicians who are trying to tear my family apart simply because my son is transgender. Trans kids don't have a political agenda. They are just kids. They just want to be left alone. My family's just like yours. We love our kids unconditionally, and we will never stop fighting for them. Stand with us. Protect our families.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you properly chastened after hearing from Amber Biggle about her family? And do you now understand that we should not support this legislation in Florida or similar legislation being advanced elsewhere around the country because it's tearing trans families apart? Or families with a family member who's trans apart. What do you think? Were you persuaded, Jeannie?
No, not at all. But I just don't understand how people think that transitioning kids is not. I mean, I think we've got a medical problem here. I think we've got a not just a cultural problem. We've got a medical problem here. Anybody who is transitioning their children and doesn't understand the long-term harmful effects on their body, it's really abuse, in my opinion. And I'm glad that DeSantis and Abbott are standing up against this culture and calling it what it is.
Disney's benefits team, the benefits team at Disney, offering resources and guides to employees transitioning to the opposite gender, as well as information for employees' children who are transitioning. This, according to information obtained by the Manhattan Institute's Christopher Rufo, who's been on the case. So they're promoters for their employees and their kids. Well, as shouldn't surprise you, given the profile of that video you just heard. Here's a question. How is not teaching gender ideology as part of the curriculum for pre-K through third grade destroying Amber Biggle and Max's family? How is it destroying the Biggle family in Texas? Because Florida is saying we're not going to get into essentially gender politics in the very early primary grades. How is that destructive of Max Biggle? I don't understand.
It's the same thing in schools, Dan. It's how is it that the you know, Wheaton-Warrenville South English teacher has to ask the entire class, tell me what your pronouns are. How is me refusing to have my daughter say anything about that, or actually me speaking up about it, how is that interfering with any other child deciding that they want to give different pronouns? I mean, that is the problem. It's everywhere, too, by the way. It's everywhere.
Mayor Pete, he's the transportation secretary for the United States. No, seriously. He is also that mannequin from the Mishawaka Macy's men's department who somehow got loose, became the mayor of South Bend, ran for president. Now he's the transportation secretary. He was on that show with those man-hating shrews like Anna Navarro called The View on Friday. and asked about this legislation in Florida that the left seems to really want to dig in on. Of course they do, because solidarity and marginality is their game, and we don't have actually marginalized populations. You need to create them so as to advance this argument you're making, and that's what Mayor Pete did.
Your husband, Chasten, is a teacher, and he's been a vocal critic of what's going on in my state of Florida with the so-called don't say gay law now, which he says will kill kids. Do you agree?
Kill.
And, you know, as a politician, because this, this strikes you as, you know, your husband is a teacher.
Yeah.
You are obviously LGBTQ yourself, and you are now a parent.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about
this? Yeah, he's right. And I think every law ought to be judged for the effect it's going to have on real people in real life. And I get the political reasons why they're doing this. By the way, some of those political reasons is they don't have a plan on anything else, right? I mean, they don't have a plan on dealing with inflation or dealing with, with gas prices or dealing with the issues of
the
day.
We can't get home insurance in Florida. So we're banning all sorts of conversations.
Right, it's easier, right? It's easier politically, but this is going to hurt people. I mean, I think.
Classic projection there.
Well, killing kids, really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
How? How is it killing children? Because we, some people will not subject their children to your ideology as part of their school curriculum. That kills kids because some people won't participate in your delusion about your children. That's killing your kid. I mean, you know, to some extent, to a large extent, you have dominion over your own child. And if you want your child's predilections to rule the roost within your household, then within limits, you're able to do that. Why do I have to celebrate it? Why do I have to fold in lest I be killing your child? You know, the hysteria of these arguments belies the lack of evidentiary or logical basis for them, it would seem to me. The more ridiculous the argument, the more of a fraud you know is being perpetrated.
Well, if we can't actually agree that you literally cannot change your sex, then I just don't know where I can find common ground on much else, because you can't understand that.
And part of this argument, Jeannie, as I'm sure you've heard, is like, you know, some people have suggested that you know, this is part of an effort to groom children, sexualize children in the early primary grade.
Sure it is.
At an early age, groom them. And then there's this human cry, how dare you suggest that kids are being groomed or that teachers are sexual predators, essentially grooming. But I guess my question is, what is the prevalence of sexual predation of children within pre-K through 12 education? You know, we had this report, expose, by the Chicago Tribune a few years ago that we spent a lot of time on this show, suggesting there were more than 500 legitimate cases of sexual predation of minors by adults within CPS. That was according to, not me, not the Tribune, according to the City of Chicago's Corp Counsel's office. And it didn't seem to go anywhere. You had a report out. I mean, these are anecdotal, I understand, but that's why I'm asking the question. You had Mike Scott reporting this morning on that high school choir teacher in Aurora who's been charged with nine counts of criminal sexual assault of a student. You've got a case out of California where teachers charged with 29 counts of lewd acts with children, including students. I mean, if this was a Catholic priest, then we'd all be discussing it, or we'd be reminding ourselves that the Catholic Church is a breeding ground for pedophiles, and we'd be believing the D.C. press corps' characterization of the Catholic Church as nothing but pedophile priests, when it's a very small fraction. Now, admittedly, and nobody has been more critical of the church's handling of this than me, but it's a small percentage, but a small percentage of a big number is a big problem, particularly when you're talking about the sexual predation of children. But why isn't that also the case in K through 12 government school systems? I don't understand.
I actually don't think DeSantis's bill goes far enough. He stops at the third grade. And why should you be talking about a lot of these issues even past the third grade? That is my problem. And we know that we have school districts where they are absolutely hiding what they're doing to children behind parents' backs and against parents' wishes. I mean, you probably remember the Jay Keck opinion piece that he wrote in USA Today. I pleaded that my daughter's school call her by her legal name, use female pronouns. By refusing, they prevented her from getting the help she needed. And this happened in Hinsdale,
yes.
Illinois.
Yes.
So, I mean, they basically said, my daughter's on the spectrum. She's got an IEP, and you're going to treat her like a girl. And she kind of fell in with a kid who was thinking that they were the other sex. And they did the opposite. The school district, behind the parents' back, did the opposite of the parents' wishes.
So is that grooming?
Yes,
is there sexualization of children going on? I mean, I'd be interested to hear from parents with school-age kids. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. I mentioned this back when we talked several years ago when we talked about that Tribune expose and CPS. But Carol Shakeshaft did a report for the federal government, Department of Education, back more than two decades ago now. She's an academic at Hofstra University. And she found in 2000, estimated, that roughly 290,000 students experienced some sort of physical sexual abuse by a public school employee over the course of 1991 to 2000. Over five decades, U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops report from 1950 to 2002, 10,667 people made allegations that priests or deacons had sexually abused them as minors. That's horrific for the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. but 10,600 over five decades. Shakeshaft, her report to DOE, 290,000 kids over the course of a single decade. And where did that go? Is that not interesting? Chris Rufo tweeted out a report from the Government Accounting Office in 2014. So this is during the Obama years. The nonpartisan GAO published a 72-page report warning about child predators in public schools, recommending that administrators monitor teachers for quote-unquote grooming behaviors that could lead to sexual misconduct or sexual abuse. And I won't go into more details on that for the purposes of this discussion. But so you have the Shakeshaft report in 2000. You have this GAO report in 2014. You have these instances that we mentioned that admittedly are anecdotal, but are they indicative of something larger going on? And then when you see the increased emphasis by the left on graphic sex ed and the whole gender identity piece of it layered in, and then you accuse this of instigating or covering for grooming behavior, there's no basis to have this conversation. That's what everyone on the left is saying virtually. And even some on the right are suggesting, oh, grooming, Disney supporting grooming, that's going too far. Is it going too far? I don't know. There's a lot of evidence to suggest we haven't gone far enough, that we're turning a blind eye to what's happening in pre-K through 12 education in this country. Isn't there?
Well, we certainly have not fought enough with our school boards over this issue. And now that the masks are off, it's time to go back to the other agendas that they're pushing in these schools, which includes this. And in Illinois, you've got that horrific SB 818 that passed, which is, you know, pornographic sex ed beginning in kindergarten.
Yeah.
You've got that bill coming up, and all these school districts are going to have to make a decision by August of 2022, what they're going to do. Are they going to implement it or not?
Kathy, St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
So in St. Charles, we've got this hot topic right now being fought in the school. I'm part of a committee that is supposed to be a connection between the community and the school board. So we meet and we discuss, hot topics. The last time we met, we had discussed the new superintendent that we need. Keep in mind that St. Charles hired a diversity, inclusion, and equity director last year to the tune of about $80,000 that has nothing to do but look for reasons to have an equity director, okay? And she's a minority, okay, fine, but I feel like that was the beginning of the end. So now they're just looking for reasons, and the superintendent position now has to, the first thing they're going to do is make some decisions based on sex education, equity and inclusion, and it's a very, very tenuous time right now because the community is split 50-50, and it's contentious. At every one of the school board meetings, at all of our committee meetings, and I'm concerned because 10-year-old, when she started going through changing hormones and getting her period and menstruation, she thought she was transgender. So she starts sixth grade and comes home with a name tag that says a boy's name. And I was blown away because nobody talked to me about that. But the school is in a position where they have to, they're trying to make the kids feel included. They're trying to make the kids feel good about themselves. And I get that. But we have to do this with the parents. And I feel like they're pushing the envelope so much. Case in point, my daughter coming home with a boy's name tag, where they're caught in the middle sometimes, not knowing what to do. And if they err on the other side, people will go ballistic. So it is a very, very tricky time right now. And I hope everybody shows up to the board meetings and fights this big time.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. Well, I mean, it's a tricky time if you're not going to acknowledge XX and XY mean something.
That's right.
I mean, then it gets a little tricky from there if it's just what somebody's thoughts are. And by the way, there's a really good piece by Brian Kaplan, who's an economist, just a statistical analysis, explaining the LGBT explosion. And I don't think he has a particular position on this. He's just looking at the data. And the explosion of LGBTQIA identities. The numbers for bisexuality. Over the course of five generations, bisexual identity has multiplied by a factor of 75. Lesbian identity has multiplied 20-fold, transgender identity 10-fold. Even gay identity is six times as common in Gen Z as among Gen X. So this is not a genealogical. This is a phenological development that's happening. And that's exactly what his conclusion is when you account for things. He tackles all the arguments, well, people coming out of the closet, it's more tolerant and so on and so forth. He said the LGBT phenotype is exploding while the LGBT genotype is imploding. And he points to the media and social and the associated sort of social contagion that was, by the way, research that was coming out of Brown University a couple of years ago before that got spiked because that doesn't fit with the left's narrative on the topic. So the socialization piece, the media thing is obvious. And it's the same reason that people estimate that the percentage of population that identifies as gay is exponentially more than the number of people who actually identify as gay because it's so omnipresent in media. But the more he also talks about, the recruitment piece, essentially the grooming, if you want to, socialization, whatever you want to call it, the more openly LGBT people you socialize with, the more likely you're to consider giving their lifestyle a try, especially if the costs of trying are low. Bisexuality. When stigma falls, this doesn't merely lead confirmed LGBTers to come out of the closet. It also means lots of straight by default people start socializing with LGBTs, which is a good way to make more LGBTs. He goes on to say, before anybody gets too exercised here, don't misunderstand me. Some people won't become gay no matter how many gays they know, just as some people won't become Mormon no matter how many Mormons they know. None of that changes the obvious fact that hanging out with Group X casually hanging out with Group X casually raises the chance that you become an X. And one strong predictor of hanging out with Group X is outreach by Group X. And so that's a part of it. And he's looking at this strictly as an economist. He is not with some family group, or he's not some social conservative. He's just looking at the numbers and saying, how do you explain this explosion over the last 50 years? And you can't explain it genealogically, so there has to be another explanation. So don't tell me that this isn't about grooming, this isn't about an agenda, this isn't ultimately about politics and political power. That's exactly what it's about. And they know it. That's why they're prosecuting it.
Well, Abigail Schreier said the same thing. She reported on basically activist teachers working to personally recruit middle school children for their LGBTQ clubs.
Well, and also thanks to TikTok, we have, you know, out and proud LGBTQIA teachers or allies saying it. They're telling us. I mean, they're not, there's no, you know,
including the
cleverness
third grade teacher in Glen Ellen.
Yes.
So, yeah, she was all over TikTok saying that.
But we're not. So when they tell us what they're doing, we're supposed to discount it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the left would have you do. And you shouldn't do it. And to Kathy and St. Charles' point, yeah, it gets complicated. It gets complicated when you get cowed by people that are running a political game on you, and you're afraid to stand up and call it out for what it is, and you're afraid to stand up and reiterate things that we all know to be true, but as we were talking about last hour, but where some of us are too afraid to do so because the loudest and most hysterical will target us, and we don't want to deal with that sort of static. Well, you either deal with that sort of static or you give away your society. That's the choice.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy checking in on Mayor Triple Threat, the Fort Toole mayor. She and Amy apparently made an evening visit to the Wiener Circle and answered the question, the difficult one for the Wiener Circle staff. If you know the Wiener Circle in Chicago, it's famous for its wieners and for the ridicule you get from staff. So how do you defile a mayor who so completely defiles herself?
This outfit is not looking lower, we out, bitch. What you want? Come on, because you better right, because I will cut her down. Now, I'm behind, she got a big dick, all right. What's up, Lori? What you want? What's up? You f***ing me tonight? You f***ing me too?
I don't think Lori's betrothed Amy was with her enjoy that as much. Although Triple Threat seemed to enjoy it very much. She had a real wiener eating grin on her face throughout that ridicule. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Good thing they didn't go to Ed DeBevick's because it's closed. But I think it would have been even tougher there. But maybe she takes it more in stride at Wiener Circle. I don't know. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Is this the best Chicago can do?
646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Is this the best Chicago can do? People like her?
Well.
Is this really where we're at? People this stupid to vote for people like this? Apparently.
Bit of a punchline, one could argue, but there are obviously others who argue or see it differently. Now, maybe some more are coming to the realization that that punchline isn't terribly funny. Chicago had 12,665 crime complaints in 2022 so far, which is up more than 9,000 for the same period in 2021, basically the first quarter of the year. That's a 36% increase.
Mm-hmm.
36% increase in crime complaints so far this year. Last year was the deadliest year in Chicago in more than a quarter century. New York City, by the way, seeing the same thing, which is why Eric Adams is at least talking about returning to broken windows policing, if not acting in furtherance of it to date. We'll have to wait and see. They've got district attorney problems there, just like we have a state's attorney problem in Cook County. Also this from Golden Tip poll. This is sort of remarkable when you think about it. One in six Americans, almost 17%, or their family members have been victims of a crime in the past 12 months. One in six. 9% say they were a victim of a crime. 7% say a family member was the victim of a crime.
Wow.
Yeah. And by race and place, 13% of whites, 23% of blacks, 25% of Hispanics. The distribution urban versus suburban is not as great as you might think. 22% urban, 14% suburban, 14% rural. So thinking of the 16% of people who said I was a victim, blacks are overrepresented. Whites are vastly underrepresented. Hispanics a little overrepresented, too. By a factor of two, like blacks. Whites are decidedly underrepresented. And then urban versus suburban versus rural. Suburban and rural about the same and just slightly below urban. And obviously that represents where you see the disproportion of black and Hispanics that are victimized by crimes because of the concentration of those groups in urban settings. One in six. And you have Mayor Triple Threat blithely wandering around saying there's not enough love in the city. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, when four were killed, 21 wounded just over this weekend. Again. Again.
And there are, you know, I mean, these are, again, these are anecdotes, but they're relevant ones. Bachelor party. Tourist bachelor party weekend begins with one robbed, another pickpocketed in River North. So if you think that young people are going to come in from the suburbs or people are going to choose Chicago as a tourist destination and Chicago's house of financial cards relies significantly on tourism, of course. And you have, I mean, even more horrific, barbaric crimes, including, I mean, I don't even want to go into it, but I saw it. There was a kidnapping of a seven-year-old child that was thwarted, a student at an elementary school, and the kidnapping was thwarted, but the sexual assault of this seven-year-old was not. I mean, he was just given over the streets to the barbarians. There is the Wall Street Journal opining over the weekend, America's shoplifting epidemic. Retail theft seems to have been normalized by many cities. Yeah, Chicago being one of them, of course, which is why the Mag Mile is a shell of its former self and will get worse before it gets better because, you know, a lot of those premier brands don't need to be on those main drags if it doesn't make financial sense for them to be there. And it's funny, too, because thinking about Illinois writ large now, getting outside Chicago, Darren Bailey, state senator who is running for governor, and as I've disclosed, I'm supporting Jeannie, as you've disclosed because you publicly endorsed him, you're supporting.
Yes.
He was taken to task by the Chicago Springfield Press Corps last week for this interview he gave for a podcast called Outside the Beltway. Mm-hmm. This is what he had to say. And tell me if this is dissimilar from what Triple Threat was saying as her explanation of root causes for violent crime in Chicago.
We should be working to keep the family unit together, to keep dads as head of the household. And because of that breakdown of which what you're explaining is exactly, it's a destruction of the family unit is what's taking place. And until we get that under control, until we empower our churches across the land and wake them up to keep the family structure together, we're going to continue to struggle with this absolute nonsense that we're dealing with. And I've been speaking for the last 3 years as a state legislator. I come off the farm in Southern Illinois. So I'm from the school of hard knocks and hard work and common sense. And unfortunately, that is missing in society today. You know, the family unit to be headed by the dad. The dad is supposed to be out, you know, teaching his children hard work ethics, honesty, and integrity. And you remove that, and then you begin to deplete all everything of morality, everything of integrity, and our children wander around lost, waiting for a Democrat Party to give them everything and teach them their ways. And you know, it's crazy that we have allowed ourselves to get where we're at in such a quick amount of time.
Is that unfair? Is that critical of households headed by moms? Is that too politicized to suggest that dads are out of the picture and then the Democrats come in with the welfare state to try to use government to fulfill the role of dad? How is that different ultimately than what Lori Lightfoot was saying the other week when she talked about unloved kids in the city? How is it really different? Maybe she doesn't fully appreciate the implications of making that generic statement, but isn't Darren Bailey attaching meaning to those words? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Well, Dan, you know, do you recall the chief executive of McDonald's and all the criticism and calls for his resignation when, you know, he sent text messages to Lori Lightfoot and seemed to blame the deaths of, you know, two Black and Latino children on gun violence, and he seemed to blame it on their parents? Huge backlash, right? He had to apologize for it all. And he says, you know, the parents failed those kids, which I know is something you can't say. He texts that to Lori Lightfoot, and he's on the hot seat, too, for saying that. Yet, you're absolutely right. Last week, Lori Lightfoot literally said, parents, you know, need to know where their kids are.
Is that just moms or two moms, or does that include dads? Mm-hmm. Because as I understand it, I mean, like Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, I am not a biologist, but as I understand it, men are involved in procreation. So,
well, as a non-parent, you don't get a say, apparently.
Yes, well, that's true too. But so that's why I'm asking. I'm not saying asking because this is, you know, beyond my ken. But
Ask Chris Kennedy. Ask Chris Kennedy because in the gubernatorial debates back in 2018, I happened to show up at a "quote unquote" gun violence, which I don't like that term, but symposium in a West Side church. And, of course, Rauner didn't show up. I was the only Republican there, along with all the candidates. And they did say, how do you curb some of this? And I actually had the audacity to basically say what Obama said is that, you know, fathers in the homes matter. And Chris Kennedy came right back at me saying, I didn't have a father in the home. And I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. Really? Get a grip.
Right. It's just like JB was raised by a single mom.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the thing. If you raise the specter of, be specific about dads, since there's so many absentee fathers, and we have a pretty big mountain of evidence about what the lack of a dad in the home means, generally speaking, for kids, particularly young boys, sort of what Darren Bailey was getting at. But if you're a conservative, you're not allowed to invoke the D word, dad. If you're Obama or Bill Cosby back in the day, you know, intermittently from time to time over the course of generations, you hear some leftist will raise this specter, and then it's like, oh, this is profound. What an insight, the courage to talk about the lack of dads in the homes. And yet, isn't Darren Bailey also right that what they you know, check that box, but what they're really interested in is government interceding where the family is broken to create dependence and reliable votes for big government, which is their stock and trade. I mean, that's the scam that they've run in the big cities and destroyed the big cities and further decimated the family. This is not a novel observation, and yet we still can't seem to get our minds around it. And we want to give Lori Lightfoot credit when she talks about loving kids, as if that's, again, an example of some profundity from the political class. What a joke.
Well, in the science, it does bear it out. They've done. It's not like they haven't done these studies. Warren Farrell, a psychologist and author of Father and Child Reunion, was intrigued with why children are active father with active fathers do so well. And he wrote about this. I'm reading from First Things. And it's he says a father's impact starts at birth. For example, boys who have contact with their father show greater levels of trust at only 5 or 6 months. A study of black infants found the more interaction the boy had with the father, the higher his mental competence and psychomotor function by the age of 6 months.
So, yeah, I mean, it is overwhelming.
I mean, why
it's,
we even have to discuss this is ridiculous.
Right.
We don't even have to do the studies. We just, you know it.
But to suggest it is to to say something that's verboten. You can suggest what the ideal situation is, lest you hurt anybody's feelings who's in less than an ideal situation, which is a absurd way to have a serious conversation about anything. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. I used to do a lot of teaching at a Christian college, and I was shocked by, you know, this problem isn't just prevalent among the unchurched. It's really crept into the church because a lot of the women that I had in my class, predominantly it was women going to the classes that I was teaching, and they were single mamas. You know, they had baby daddy donors someplace. And they were churched, and I recall being criticized because I would like naively assume that if they're in class, they're church people, that they don't have this kind of single mama, you know, popping babies out by a number of different dads. Yet that was still there, and I got schooled by a gal who very much wanted to make it clear to me that she waited until she got married before she had any children, and she was the outcast in her group. And I thought, okay, this problem is way bigger than what people are just acknowledging as, you know, like some sort of ghetto issue. This entitlement garbage has crept everywhere.
No question. Thanks for the call, Rob. No, I mean, it is a cultural dysfunction that transcends race. It's more pronounced, as we know, just by the numbers in the black community, in the Latino community, but not by much. And it is a cultural dysfunction across the board. The reliance on the state rather than mom and dad. Dan and Jeannie Ives in for Amy J, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, former state legislator Jeannie Ives, and she'll be talking West Point Shop with Jim Carafano in just a second, a couple of West Pointers. But first, last night, Zelensky was treated to a hagiographic interview by Scott Pelley, and in that discussion, he was asked about his supposed tough talk to the Western world, the sort of undiplomatic diplomacy that he's practicing, and he explained,
"I'm no longer interested in their diplomacy that leads to the destruction of my country. A lot of countries have changed their mind about Ukraine and about our people, but I think we've paid too high a price for that.
What must the world understand?
We are defending the ability of a person to live in the modern world. We are defending the right to live. I never thought this right was so costly. These are human values, so that Russia doesn't choose what we should do and how I'm exercising my rights. That right was given to me by God and my parents.
I don't disagree with them, but I would raise the question as to whether or not Ukraine should be dictating what we should choose to do. Zelensky went on to renew his demand for a Western or American or NATO-enforced no-fly zone with a comparison to World War II, sort of challenging America and the West morally.
He told us, I remember, all of us remember, books about the Second World War and about the devil in uniform, Adolf Hitler. Are those countries who did not participate in the war responsible? The countries who let German forces march throughout Europe. Does the world carry responsibility for the genocide? Yes. Yes, it does. When you have the ability to close the sky. Yes, it's scary that a world war could start. It's scary, I understand that. And I cannot put pressure on these people because everyone is afraid of war. But whether the world is responsible for this, I believe so. Yes, I believe so. Stand in front of the mirror every day and ask yourself, were you able to do something or were you unable to do something? You will find the answer in the mirror to this question and to another question. Who are you? That's what I believe.
For an answer to the man in the mirror question, please be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of the book Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, what's the answer to the man in the mirror question?
Well, there's a doctrine that has been out for decades, and it really, I think, picked up after the Rwandan genocide, and it's called the right to protect, and which is the notion that if there are gross human rights abuses, that countries have both a right and an obligation to intervene to deal with that. There's a reason why that doctrine never really took off. And it actually goes to the point that Zelensky was talking about is there's this balance between national sovereignty and being the global policeman, and neither one of them are his thing, man in the mirror thing. I mean, that's as likely to lead to war as indifference and turning your back. So look, I mean, I think this is why we have something called national interests, which are, if everybody, I mean, the most stable system that we've ever seen is people looking after the interests of their own people. And that's why we have, vital interests when America is directly threatened, we should step up and defend ourselves. Where we have, important interests, where we're trying to deal with things like genocides and the kind of things that Zelensky's talking about, we should do what we can and where it was appropriate, consistent with our interests. And I think we have to find those balance. We haven't had those hard conversations. So I understand where Zelensky's coming from. I think he's trying to protect his country. But the reality is Ukraine is not a treaty ally. The United States is not obligated to defend Ukraine. We can protect our vital interests by defending the blue line, which is NATO. And I think that's what we're going to do.
Else too. I mean, of course, you're not going to get this pushback from a simp like Scott Pelley. But President Zelensky, if that's the standard, then is Ukraine responsible for not leading the charge to liberate the Uyghur concentration camps in China? Where were you when Rohingya Muslims were being persecuted in Myanmar? Or is that America's and the Western world's fault too?
And I'll give you a good example. So where were the Ukrainians? Well, the Ukrainians were with us in Afghanistan, which was fine, right? And that's something that's appropriate to both their interests and their abilities. But your point is well taken. The problem with the right to protect is, where does it end? I mean, if the United States has a moral obligation to intervene for a million Uyghurs in China, that's essentially means we're going to have a war with China. How many people are going to die in that war? Probably billions. So this gets to this, if you go back, I mean, if we're going to deeply philosophical about this, the whole moral philosophy of the Western understanding of the appropriate use of force is rooted in something called just war theory. And one of the tenets, the principal tenets of just war theory is this thing of proportionality, which is in engaging in a war, you should not do more damage, more evil than you would have if you didn't engage. And so this question of proportionality does get to, are we going to risk war with another nuclear power over Ukraine? And the answer is no, because it's not a proportional response, and that kind of restraint is what led the Cuban Missile Crisis not to erupt into World War III, where both the United States and Russia sat down and said, no, we're not going to fight World War III over Cuba. And that element of restraint is as important as standing up and doing the right thing. So I'm with Zelensky that if the West had shown moral backbone and done the things it should have done a year ago that it's doing now, probably wouldn't have been a war. If we had armed the Ukrainians to give them food, water, medical supplies, and enabled them to defend themselves against Russia, Putin may have never invaded to begin with. And we didn't do those things. And I think that is a moral failure on our part. And I think supporting Ukraine is exactly the right thing to do. But the reality is no matter how much Zelensky asked for this, the West is not going to widen the war to help defend Ukraine. They're going to provide means for Ukraine to defend itself, and that's actually Ukraine's responsibility. But we're not going to fight for them because they're not part of our alliance.
And when Zelensky said yesterday that in addition to the no-fly zone that he wanted, he also said we need more weapons delivered faster. Is that a legitimate criticism of the Western response, that we're not getting the weapons they need to them in sufficient quantities fast enough?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And if you go back and you look at the particularly the U.S. response was, well, we don't want to do anything before the war. We don't want to do anything because that might trigger a war, right? And then when the war started, is, well, we don't think that Ukraine's going to survive, so let's just do nothing. And then once the war lengthened, we were like, oh, well, we don't want to do more because the Russians will see that as escalatory. Well, all these things are really nonsense. You know, as I said 1,000 times on your show, Putin respects what we do, not what we say. Aiding a belligerent is not being a belligerent in the war. And the more we aid Ukraine, the much more likely is that the Russians will be stopped in their tracks. And we'll all be safer for that. So I absolutely. And the reason why it wasn't there was in large part because we were afraid that we were going to antagonize Putin. And that's exactly what he was banking on when he invaded to begin with.
Now you have Ukraine saying that they're, with Russia reconstituting its forces, they're preparing for a barrage in eastern Ukraine, and Putin has essentially reverted back to his interests in the Donbass region and through Mariupol to Crimea, land bridge there, and so that portion of the country. Is that your assessment of what Putin is aiming to do at this point?
So we're all just guessing.
Yeah.
So I could be wrong, but if you look at what's out there now, it appears to be kind of three things. One is, well, absolutely, there's no question that he's reconstituting forces in the south and the east. Mm-hmm. More than likely, do another offensive just so he can, get someplace on a high note to say, well, we accomplished X or whatever. And, they often talk to May 9th as, the date of the great victory in the Patriotic War. It's symbolic to do that. So probably going to be an offensive before May 9th. Probably not in the next couple of days, because it's probably still going to take him some time to do that. That's one. The other thing is we clearly see a lot of suggest that Putin is also moving to Plan B, which is to do the things to ramp up the most pressure on the Ukrainians to agree to a deal. And that is continue the terror campaign of killing civilians. The thinking is the more civilians we kill, the more randomly across the country, the more the Ukrainians are going to recognize we should just cut a deal. And the other one is they've literally forced the repatriation of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians back to Russia. Those are all bargaining chips. So it sounds like he's going to do another offensive, see what happens, and then if it's, you know, not, you know, unless it's wildly successful, then he will go for some hard deal, owning part of the country, threatening to kill more civilians, and bargaining the future essentially the population that he's kidnapped and back in Russia.
But history's not on his side. I mean, we've seen this play out before, and you know, when you've got a populace like Ukraine has proven that wants to fight back, you can't occupy them with any success. You can't hold that ground with Russian forces for any long time.
Well, he can hold the ground that he's hold because he's largely depopulated of Ukrainians. I mean, it's, you know, Donbass is largely a wasteland of nothing. So, if he digs in, and he's fighting a defensive war, if he can, you know, particularly with a lot of artillery, he can hold a lot of ground. And even the Ukrainians have said that the liberation of Ukraine would require 50,000 to 60,000, you know, well-armed troops that they just don't have. And as you know, you know, offense and defense are very different. When you're on defense, all you need a guy to do is sit there in the foxhole and not run away. When you're on offense, you know, you need a much more well-trained, more sophisticated military. So it's unlikely that Zelensky will ever get enough force together to actually forcibly eject Russia from completely from the country. But you know, the point, I mean, the reality is as long as the West is arming Zelensky, he can fight forever, and the Russians can fight forever, and they can always go back, rearm, refit, and come back. So this will grind to a halt when the two leaders agree to do that. And it seems like that, you know, if you read what's out there now, that seems to be the direction that Putin is headed, and that will be in the coming weeks. On the other hand, look, if Putin puts all the troops in the south and he's got a new commander in charge and he has an offensive and he makes dramatic advances, maybe he'll keep fighting. So, you know, I it's over when they say it's over.
Well, you put it in terms of weeks. Last week before the House Armed Services Committee, you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, put it in terms of years. Now, maybe he meant that there'll be years of sort of after effect skirmishes and insurgencies and so forth if Russia controls some additional portion of Ukraine, the eastern part that Putin has designs on. But he was not clear on that. What was your interpretation of what Milley said?
Well, he also said the word be over in 72 hours, so yeah. I'm not sure he's the best military Nostradamus.
Yeah, well.
They could fight for years. I mean, it would be more of a kind of a waxing and waning of things. But, you know, remember, you know, people often say, well, Russia has an economy the size of Texas, which is kind of an insult to Texas. But the reality, that's a pretty big economy, and it dwarfs the Ukrainian economy. So the Russians can fight on for a very, very, very long time if they want to.
Well, and they can continue to fight on as long as Putin's earning $1 billion a day in oil from the EU.
Well, this really gets to the core of it. We have very limited capacity to determine the future of Ukraine, other than what we're doing now. We have an enormous capacity to determine the future of Europe. And the things that make Putin a threat to us are his military and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And after this, however this war ends in the next weeks and months, Putin's not going to be able to invade anybody anytime soon. So we have an opportunity to ramp up our conventional and strategic deterrence, to move to energy independence, to move to energy dominance. And these are things that will make a huge difference. And the number one fear I have right now is not how the war in the Ukraine is going to play out. The number one fear I have right now is the two things that have to get done to make us, the Atlantic community, United States and around us, Europe, safe over the long term. I'm seeing no leadership from the White House in doing those things. That is what really worries me.
So Jen Psaki was on Fox News Sunday over the weekend talking to Dana Perino, and she was asked about the state of the Iran nuclear deal being negotiated with Putin, And she said this.
Can Russia continue to be at the table for these Iran negotiations?
Well, Dana, here's how we look at it. And you know this from your many past experiences. Diplomacy, foreign affairs, it's complicated. And this is an example of that. We believe, and I think most of the global community believes, that preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon is in our national interest and our global interest. The president is only going to agree to a deal if it is a good deal. But we have been dealing with the experiment of President Trump pulling out of the deal. And what we've seen is a lack of visibility. Iran has made great progress in being able to move towards acquiring a nuclear weapon. That's not in our interest. Russia has been a member of the P5+1. They have been played an implementation role. That's what we're talking about and what's been under discussion in these negotiations. We don't know that we will come to an agreement, though. It's ongoing and we're still considering it.
Last week, we talked to Noah Rothman from Commentary, and he suggested that any sort of deal was DOA. What's your perspective and comment on what Psaki had to say?
Well, this is this administration is so desperate for a deal. And what you just heard should so make Americans terrified every day about who's running this country. Mm-hmm. What she basically said was absolute, complete nonsense. Because the reality is we already know the deal is bad. So for a good deal, well, they jettisoned that months ago. And the reality is actually the White House has even said this. There is no Iran deal. There is no Iran deal that can be signed which will prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Even officials in the White House said that. So what she just said was complete and utter nonsense. And not to mention the fact is, how would you then prevent, if you did this deal, which is going to be awful and terrible and horrible, how would you prevent the Russians from using it as a backdoor to undermine every single sanction that you've put in place and make the Russian economy just as powerful, if not more powerful, than when they started? She has no answer for that. This is why when I said I'm worried that they're not going to do the right things. I mean, the right things in Europe are deterrence and energy independence. The right things in the Middle East are no Iran deal and building up a powerful coalition through the Abraham Accords of Arab and Israelis to block Iranian expansion of the region. Those are the hard things. And when they say it's the last administration's fault, we are 2 years into this presidency, and apparently there are still things which are Trump's fault. Which, again, is just excuse-making.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former state legislator and current principal of Breakthrough Ideas, Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, America's greatest living playwright, who I once had the pleasure to interview on a previous station I worked for.
Mm-hmm. And David, I asked you that question. I asked you, what's your most favorite interview, but you're one you're most proud of, and it was Mr. Mamet.
David Mamet, he is right up there. I would say second to Elie Wiesel, the author of the concentration camp survivor and the Nobel Prize winning author of Night. But Mamet was right there because he's America's greatest living playwright and a Chicagoan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on with Bill Maher over the weekend. I don't know why he made that choice, but anyway. He's got a new book out called Recessional. But when I interviewed him, it was almost a decade ago, it's got to be, when he came out with his book, The Secret Knowledge, which essentially was him chronicling his move away from what leftism had become. And spoiler alert, The Secret Knowledge is no one has the secret knowledge. But now he's tackling free speech. In this era where free speech is under threat by the left, he had this to say.
The point is we have to have free speech. If free speech is when we have nothing, because if one group takes the high road, it doesn't matter which group it is, if they're in power long enough, we're going to have a police state. So when it's not acceptable to have an opposing view, when people who state an opposing view are not disagreed with, but marginalized and canceled, we're going to end up with a totalitarian state because that's the way human nature works.
For more on human nature, we're pleased to be joined by Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Does Mamet have it about right?
Oh, of course he does. And I just bought his new book. Looking forward to reading it.
Yeah, it's a good one. And so what's your assessment of where we're at on this continuum that Mamet described of you're not allowed to disagree, then you're on your way to a totalitarian state?
Well, if we take the universities as the sort of prophecy of what's coming for the country as a whole, we're already there. These universities had suppressed free speech, both by preventing people from saying what they want to say, but also by forcing them to say things they don't want to say, has already created a social system that is in many senses totalitarian. And what they're teaching the children, their students, they grow up into being adults who think that that's okay. And we see that around us in almost every institution. Certainly it is part of our politics now. It's part of our entertainment industry. It's part of what we do as a country every day in preventing people from talking about, oh, say, the 2020 election or the January 6th Capitol Hill event. The censors, the people who decide what you can say without getting into trouble, are lined up on one side of the political spectrum. But Mamet's point, of course, is that anyone who's in power too long is able to bend the rules in their own favor. And the same thing would probably be true if we had a consistently right-wing government, which we haven't had for quite a while. And therefore, when we look at this, we see something other than symmetry. There is one force, really, that is imposing its censorship on us at the moment, and that comes out of the Democratic Party.
You probably saw this confab last week we discussed on Friday at University of Chicago, David Axelrod's Institute for Political Skullduggery. I think it goes by a different name, but that's what it is. and it featured deep thinkers like CNN's Magic Cue Ball, Brian Stelter, and The Atlantic's Annie Applebaum. And Applebaum was asked by one of the University of Chicago undergrads who was actually thinking about the Hunter laptop story and its the censorship it suffered at the hands of the D.C. press corps, with the exception of the New York Post, of course. And she basically said, you know, it's not an interesting story to me. I thought it was just, you know, these kids did a great job of having these journalistic mavens indict themselves in answering these very straightforward questions. If it's not interesting to Applebaum at The Atlantic, then it's not a story.
Well, it was interesting enough to Applebaum for her to spend a lot of time and a lot of ink denouncing the laptop. So it only becomes uninteresting to her when it turns out that everything she said was false, that the laptop was legitimate all along. The New York Post had correctly broken the story, and it was she and people like her who were all intent on suppressing the story in favor of Biden. So I do believe that those students did a brilliant job in exposing the hypocrisy of these press mavens and also of sort of flushing out into the open just how brazen someone like Ann Applebaum can be. Bias any? You know, she's completely on one side of the political spectrum and willing to use all the power she can muster to enforce her point of view. The Seltzer's just a dim bulb, so not much to say about it.
Yeah, well, yes, that is a fair summation. You wrote an interesting piece in The Spectator, and it's a little bit counterintuitive until you get into the meat of it, but how questioning authority gave us wokeness. Now, people say that, well, wait a second. Of course we question authority. Nobody's beyond reproach, and we should always question those who have the reins of power. But that's not really what you're arguing. Explain your argument.
Well, my argument is that the taste for questioning authority brought us to a point where the traditional ideas of rational inquiry themselves were pushed off the table, and it allowed ideologues, propagandists, to come in and say, you better believe us. So it is a paradox for sure. And I'm a rational academic myself who likes to question authority, but questioning authority in the sense of bringing evidence to bear on matters rather than trying to force your opinion down other people's throats. What we get with the question authority stuff is, well, Disney Corporation questioning the authority of DeSantis and the Florida legislature and deciding that parents should have the authority to choose what kind of moral upbringing their children should have and at what age they should be learning about sex matters. When it came to COVID, we had the questioning authority of the people who signed the Great Barrington Declaration, that is, the doctors who believed the disease could and should be treated rather than the ones who believed that we should just shut down our society for a couple of years. So it becomes a sort of sword that can be used to punish people who are asking the right kinds of questions. And that the question authority always means questioning the authority of legitimate science, legitimate authority of institutions such as parenthood. And we are therefore in a kind of mixed up situation. I know plenty of conservatives who love the idea of question authority, but they need to think it through. And it's really become such a handy tool in the hands of progressives to prevent people from asking the questions that should be asked, that I think that phrase has to be looked on with its own kind of skepticism. As I said in the article, I grew up when in the era in which the black and white bumper sticker question authority was all over the place, and almost immediately began to wonder, who says? Who is it who's commanding us to question authority? Where do they get their authority?
You know, I want to just jump in here. So questioning authority usually was something that you maybe felt was more like something that the youth would do, the younger set. And Mr. Swaim, he writes about David Mamet's book, and he says, you know, my own observation suggests that some substantial minority do not buy it among the youth. I've spoken since 2017. It indicates that the social pressure to signal assent to eroding a series of orthodoxies from public health to race to gender has sparked a quiet revolt. And I think that's what we have. We have a quiet revolt. Mr. Mamet went on to say, he says, I think a lot of them just aren't scared anymore, but I think there's something different here. I think they just don't care anymore. They're just going to go around, live their life the way they did, get in and out of school, get in and out of college, get in and out of their job set. And they're not interested in questioning authority because it's not worth it to them to do so. They don't see it as a greater cause.
Right. Well, I think that there's a lot to that, although I would say having a completely apathetic life, not caring anything about anything is a problem, too. We want people to be, for example, interested in what it takes to make a republic like ours run. They have to know some things. They have to be more than just saturated with whatever entertainment they're getting out of YouTube or other social media. So, yeah, it's good that they're not questioning authority in the programmatic way that the left wants, but maybe they should. Where do you get some pushback against the Black Lives Matter narrative that America is a completely oppressive place? If you're going to be taught that for all the years in school, or if you're going to be taught that climate change is bringing about existential disaster, maybe you should learn some of the skills of questioning authority. That just being, I don't care anymore, I'm going to live my life, leads to a kind of emptiness that is not going to sustain our country.
Well, in addition to that, the old saw that just because you don't take an interest in government doesn't mean government won't take an interest in you. You can be
exactly
indifferent, but there are people that are not indifferent, and they're very motivated and concerned about lording over you and your life. So the sort of life you think you can have by just ignoring things that are uncomfortable may not be the life you can actually access by the time the ideologues are done with you.
Well, and I think that's where COVID weighed in. I think COVID woke up a lot of those folks saying that I can no longer stand on the sidelines. So you did get this sort of revolt at the school board meetings going on from people who had never had an interest in politics before, which is going to make 2022 very interesting. But I'm just saying among high school students, college students that I personally know, I mean, they're just like, I just want to get done with the class, Mom. I just want to get out of it.
Well, I can hardly blame them from wanting to get out of it since they sit day after day hearing the same political doctrines rolled at them from every which direction. So taking refuge in kind of privacy and just going through the motions is certainly a temptation for people. But I much more respect those students at the University of Chicago who stood up against the political elite of our press corps. They weren't saying it's just going to roll off me. They were actually informing themselves of the facts and thrusting those back at the people who'd been lying to them.
He is Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And in for Amy this morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, let's put these acquittals that were announced on Friday in some context. I'm talking about the four men that were on trial for plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Two acquitted. The jury hung on the other two, and federal prosecutors say they'll be retried. But when those charges were announced a month before the 2020 election, you had the D.C. press corps in full hyperventilation. For example, the detestable John Heilman on the even more detestable Morning Joe program, one of the contributors there, one of these serious journalists inside the Beltway. This is what Heilman said on the occasion of those indictments.
It never hurts to remind people of the context here. The president said, liberate Michigan. The president started this fire, right? He lit the fire. He sparked the match. He threw it on the kindling. And then these Wolverine militia, domestic terrorist morons came up with this plot to not just kidnap the governor. It really upsets me every time I hear someone talk about it's a plot to kidnap the governor. They were going to take her off in the woods in Wisconsin and execute her like Al-Qaeda style. That was the plan, right? So they may not be able to make that stick as a matter of law, but that was their intent. They were going to put her on trial in the woods. You know what the verdict was going to be in that trial. So Donald Trump, having lit the fire, now luckily law enforcement was able to douse the fire. And here comes the president 2 weeks from Election Day trying to restart it and then pour gasoline on top of it. On top of that, I agree with you. It's so easy to be hyperbolic about Donald Trump. It's also easy to just get used to it. It's like we want to try to find the right way to talk about this. But that is he engaged in incitement to domestic terrorism.
And Heilman engaged in, you know, election manipulation, in my opinion. Where's his apology now?
Oh, he doesn't want to be hyperbolic, Jeannie. Who are the idiots now? Exactly.
Yeah.
Mr. Heilman?
Yeah.
You had two dozen individuals allegedly involved in this conspiracy. Half of them were FBI agents. You had two individuals who pled out and were government witnesses against the four charged, and still the jury came back with full acquittals on two, and they hung on the other two.
It's just remarkable.
And yet I get this, again, with all due respect, because I like him, but Kevin Williamson writing in National Review about you know, not overstating or over extrapolating from this verdict on Friday. He writes, all this means is that the prosecution failed to prove its case to the satisfaction of the jury. That's it. This happens pretty often. Pretty often? You know, I'll have to check my data with our next guest, Andy McCarthy. But I understand that federal prosecutors' conviction rates are normally in the 95 to 98% range. This happens pretty often. No, I don't think it does, number one, and it certainly doesn't happen in highly politicized cases that are used by one political party to score cheap points at the expense of another political party, or at least attempt to, which is exactly what the left did for the weeks leading up to the election, talking about domestic terrorism. And since the election and the installment of Joe Biden as president, DOJ and FBI have continued to prosecute this narrative that domestic terrorism, white supremacy, plots like those that were hatched in Michigan are some sort of existential threat to our democracy.
Yes, to the point of also doing overly intrusive reviews of the military social media, looking for white supremacy, you know, insurrectionists there. I mean, this is the setup. If people don't understand that, right? The Whitmer situation set up then the overreaction to the January 6th riots that set up then the overreaction to how we are looking at our military. I mean, it's terrible what they've done.
And here again, as I mentioned earlier in the program when we discussed it, there are not enough FBI agents in the world to get me to go along with some plot to kidnap a governor. Okay, so this is not a defense of the militia members, except to the extent that you have the federal law enforcement agency, the domestic federal law enforcement agency, engaged in what apparently the jury concluded was entrapment, at least for two of the four. And maybe ultimately for four of the four. At least some jury members thought it was for four of the four.
Well, and, you know, Kevin Williamson should understand, too. They spent 13 days taking testimony in this case. This wasn't a one-week deal. 13 days, and then he just wants to say that the jury made the wrong decision, that they just didn't have enough evidence.
The jury clearly didn't find the FBI and thus the state's case particularly credible. Mm-hmm. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing international review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Happy Monday.
Thank you. What's your take on that verdict? And I mean, I don't, you know, want, you know, don't need you to pick a fight with Kevin Williamson. I'll do that. But I mean, this is not something where you just say, oh, you know, sometimes a jury just goes this way. It's a shoulder shrug. There's nothing to see here.
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of different things, Dan. What you said about 95 to 98% conviction rate, that's true. But there is a lower percentage of success in cases that actually go to trial. The thing is that like 95 to 98% of cases are disposed of by plea. There are very few trials anymore.
Yeah.
So it's not as unusual to get acquittals at trial. Usually you get mixed verdicts. You know, you don't usually see like a acquittal across the board. And here, I guess it's an acquittal of two and a hung jury on two others. And as I understand it, there's at least two more trials. So the final verdict hasn't been written on this. But I think one of the last things you said is probably the most important consideration here. When I tried the terrorists who were involved in the World Trade Center attack and then a plot to bomb New York City landmarks in the mid-1990s, the big defense in the trial was, especially on the landmarks plot, that some of the guys said that they had been entrapped into it by an FBI informant. And what I ended up asking the jury at the end of the case is, what would someone have to do to entrap you into committing a mass murder attack? And I think that really is basically what it comes down to. When you see entrapment There's legal entrapment, which is a very hard defense for a defendant to make, because you have to show either that the government proposed the plot, or even if the government did propose the plot, that the defendant was predisposed to commit it. It's a very hard legal defense. But then there's also what I would call equitable entrapment, and that is, even if you can't make the legal defense of entrapment, there's a certain point where there's so much government involvement in the case that the jury thinks it stinks. And the question always is it how serious is the crime? So if you're talking about a mass murder attack where the FBI has a really legitimate reason to think that Americans are going to be killed, and what happened in our case, of course, is the World Trade Center was bombed first by these guys. So, you know, there's a certain level of seriousness that you know they have. And the jury gives the FBI a wide berth to investigate that because they don't want to see it happen again. On the other end of it, I remember a terrible case in New York when I was a prosecutor where the postal inspectors spent like almost 2 years trying to get a guy to buy child pornography before he finally threw up his hands, like on the 18th or 19th time they solicited him and said, yeah, sure, let's, you know, try it. And I think the jury hated that case. And, you know, that's the difference. If it's a very serious crime and you have real concern, the jury's going to give the FBI a wide berth. But it's got to be serious, and they have to go about the investigation in a serious way.
Well, right. And so based on those observations, what does it say about the state's case in the Whitmer matter?
Well, I would say two things about that. Number one, it looks like there was a great deal of FBI involvement. Now, these are things that, you know, it's easy to mistake quantity and quality. Like, you know, if there was a real plot to kidnap the governor, and, you know, you really believe that, and especially, you know, they're going to take her to the woods and try her and execute her and all that stuff that they say. If you could convince the jury that there were two or three guys that got together and wanted to do that without any input from the FBI, I don't think it would matter to people how many FBI agents they assigned to it to stop
right.
it.
Right.
At the same right. time, if it looks like it's an ambiguous thing, and you got a bunch of guys talking nonsense, but it doesn't look like they'd ever do anything, and you put a phalanx of FBI agents into it to move the thing along, to turn it into something real when it wasn't something real in the first place, then I think that's the kind of case that the jury thinks is terrible.
And that clearly is the kind of case that this jury thought was at bar here.
Yep.
And so what does that say about the FBI? Here we are again. And, I mean, I'm as much of a law and order guy as I am in the Holman Jenkins camp now, which is Christopher Wray has had time to try to put the Jim Comey tenure of the FBI in the rearview mirror. And I don't see a agency that has shown any ability to reform itself from within. And this is yet another such case. I mean, over 20 years, I know you're picking out some high profile cases out of the thousands of cases the FBI tries, but pursues and are tried by federal prosecutors. But I mean, from Richard Jewell to anthrax to Nassar to Russian collusion to now this.
Well, Dan, look, you get no argument from me. I think that this is not, you know, look, if this was a one-off, everybody would say that, you know, look, a bad case happens every now and then, but, you know, there are thousands of other cases. But this comes on top of a lot of bad behavior and a lot of abuse of the Bureau's national security powers, which nobody's really been held accountable for, other than the fact that they've all been fired, which is not, you know, a small thing. But still, you know, there's not been any historical accountability for that. And I wrote about a case over the weekend in connection with the January 6th mess where, you know, I think it's one thing to take people who assaulted police officers and badly injured police officers and all this other stuff. But this was a case where a guy got acquitted last week where it was just some jerk who was walking through the Capitol. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything violent. It turned out that the police had waved him in.
Yeah,
and it, you know, the FBI got, you know, they had an informant in the guy's business who told them the guy took a day off on January 6th. They got a search warrant to get the cell site information to confirm that the guy was in the vicinity of the Capitol. Then they ran to Santa Fe, New Mexico to track the guy down. And he told them, he waived his right against self-incrimination. And he told them, I didn't do anything violent. I didn't do anything violent to get in. I wouldn't have gone in if the police hadn't waved me in. They bring him back 2,000 miles from Santa Fe to Washington to try him on 4 misdemeanor counts, which were nonsense. And the judge acquitted him last week. Now, you know, I think people look at that and they say, you know, there's politicized excess here. You want to go after the people who bashed the cops with, you know, hard objects and sprayed them and all that other stuff. I think everybody who's sensible supports that. But if, you know, just because people were walking through the Capitol, not doing anything, so the Biden administration can say that this is the biggest investigation of all time and they have the most defendants of all time. You know, if they just stuck to the people who committed actual crimes, which would be probably a couple of hundred people, that would keep them in business for 4 or 5 years trying cases. But no, they've got 700 people and they brought in like every Nimrod who was, you know, gawking his way through the Capitol, but not actually doing anything.
So how many FBI informants were there on January 6th?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. You know, I know
it's
that they
greater than zero, though.
They had. Oh, yeah, for sure. And I hope it was. I hope that they infiltrated these groups if there were groups that you're legitimately worried about. But, you know, look, there were several thousand people at the Capitol. The FBI didn't entrap people into attacking the Capitol. That's, you know.
Well, ridiculous. I agree with that. I absolutely believe that you make your own individual decision at that point. At the same time, the FBI did find no evidence that there was an organized plot to overturn the presidential election.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know if they've, you know.
There was a report that came out on that.
They certainly haven't. They certainly have not charged anyone with that. Now, this January 6th committee in Congress is trying to run with that theory, and we'll have to see what they come up with. I don't think that there's any evidence of that at this point.
Yeah, and so then where are you with respect to the agency itself, the FBI?
Well, I think it needs to be reformed. I've been saying, Dan, for over a couple of years now, that this is antithetical to the position I took when I was in the Justice Department, but I don't think you can argue with reality. I think their national security mission should be taken away. I think they should stick to law and order, meaning domestic policing. I don't think they should have a national security mission, and they need to be better regulated by Congress. I wouldn't burn the whole thing down because you're going to have a federal police agency of some kind, but I do think it needs to be restructured, and there needs to be much more oversight of it. And I think one of the ways that you turn it back into what the FBI traditionally was, which was a very fine police agency, where you investigate crime, is to take away from it the national security mission, where you're not really trying to investigate crime. You're trying to prevent, bad things from happening. That ought to be the province of an intelligence agency. I don't think the FBI should mix the two missions because they don't do them well together.
He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor to National Review and author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Have a great week.
You too. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, excuse me, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the principal of Breakthrough Ideas. And we just had a good conversation about the rule of law and these agencies, particularly the FBI, with Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, talking about the case of the alleged plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer and the two acquittals on Friday with a jury in Michigan hanging on the two other individuals charged, who the federal government says they will retry. But I want to get into some of the details of the case, too, because they're rather stunning, and there hasn't been very much coverage of the case over the last 2 years for obvious reasons. The person who's perhaps done the most diligent coverage, and not much competition there since there was a Beltway blackout on it, effectively, is Julie Kelly. She's a senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com, author of Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down a President. Julie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Jeannie. Thanks for having me on.
So on the Whitmer case, the government's case against these Michigan militia types, tell us about the government's star witness, Big Dan, the star witness.
Yeah, so first, it's important to underscore the operation included at least a dozen FBI undercover agents and informants who are largely responsible for conceiving this plot, for executing it, paying for it, and luring these men into it, and then ultimately arresting them in October of 2020. The main informant was a man named Dan Chappell from Michigan. He was hired as an informant in March of 2020, compensated at least $60,000 from the FBI for about 6 months' work in really pulling off the string of this operation. He took the stand for about 3 days in this three-week trial. Obviously, the jury was not convinced by his testimony. He tried to portray himself as someone who was helping to infiltrate and thwart this plot rather than what he really was, which is stitching all of these men together who did not know each other before the FBI became involved, paying for excursions to training sites and surveillance trips up to Gretchen Whitmer's vacation cottage where allegedly the kidnapping was supposed to go down. And so ultimately the jury not only disbelieved what Dan Chappell was saying, but numerous FBI undercover agents and experts who took the stand to defend the government's case. It really is stunning. Stunning is the word to not get a single conviction out of this now 18-month investigation and prosecution where the government had everything going for it, Dan and Jeannie, including numerous favorable rulings by the judge.
Well, so
away from the court. The jury.
So this Big Dan guy was basically this Stephen Helper of the kidnapping plot. Stephen Helper, for those who don't remember, the FBI asset in the Russian collusion investigation, one of them. So here we go again. This is their MO, it would seem. Now, it's not that they didn't get any convictions because they had two individuals plead out and testify against the four on trial. And despite that testimony, you still had two acquittals and two individuals who were, for whom a mistrial was declared.
Right. So the two men, Ty Garvin and Caleb Franks, pleaded guilty. Caleb Franks' attorney actually is one of the best ones who put together all the evidence of entrapment in motions. But what the government threatened against Caleb Franks was not only a psych evaluation against him that would be posted online, of course, on Placer, but also threatened to charge him with a gun charge. So right before this case was scheduled to go to trial, he accepted a plea deal. Ty Garvin accepted one last summer. But they did it, of course, and had to explain to the jury that they did it for dramatically reduced sentences, including for their testimony. What Caleb Franks and Ty Garvin really did was undermine their own testimony that they gave to FBI agents right after they were arrested, which said this wasn't serious, it was LARPing, and they blamed Dan Chappell for putting this together. But on the stand, both of them claimed that they did not recall their earlier testimony and now had changed their story. Of course, this jury did not buy it, and so I'm not really sure what's going to happen to them. It would be unfortunate if they were the only two to go to jail on this concocted plot because the government forced them into these plea deals and signed confessions that there was no entrapment.
And the performance of the FBI here, I mentioned earlier in the program that the former head of the former special agent in charge of the Detroit field office subsequently has been moved to D.C. to be the assistant agent in charge of that field office. And he's in part overseeing the 1-6 investigation. But before you even got to him, you had FBI honchos in Detroit that were fired or had all kinds of problems because of their own ethical conduct, not necessarily even related to this case, but also including this case.
Yeah, I mean, it's really illuminates sort of these lowlifes who are FBI agents and informants. So you had one of the chief agents in charge who signed the federal criminal complaint against these men, who was arrested for beating his wife in a drunken rage last summer after a swingers party. He was not just removed from the case, but fired. The other two FBI agents who handled Dan Chappell also were removed from the case and from the witness list by the government for other malfeasance related to misconduct with the FBI. The number two informant, Stephen Robeson, who operated out of numerous FBI field offices, by the way, is a convicted felon with a rap sheet in 9 states, who committed at least 2 other crimes while he was working with Caper. The government threatened to charge him with other crimes. He warned that he was going to plead the fifth, and therefore the judge removed him from the defense's witness list. He wasn't going to testify for the government. The defense wanted him as a hostile witness to explain what he did, because he with Dan Chappell really were the two informants who were really responsible for this operation.
Are there any honest FBI agents out there? If so, I mean, I want to hear from you myself, because this is frightening. That, first of all, these people, they wouldn't even get a security clearance with a record like that. And I don't know, are they being dismissed from the FBI, any of these rogue agents?
Well, Richard Trask is the only one, the man who beat his wife, and he was fired because, of course, it produced all these negative headlines for the case last year. But you know what, Jeannie and Dan, I just said this in an earlier interview. Where are the whistleblowers for the FBI? Where are the decent men and women? This is not what a lot of them signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, say, the January 6th prosecution, this is being run out of 56 field offices. These are armed agents who are conducting pre-dawn raids at Americans' homes using battering rams and SWAT vehicles, pointing rifles at children, handcuffing people, parents in front of their young children, pointing rifles at elderly spouses. I write about this in my book about January 6th. This is what this FBI did, is doing to this day. And I will say, anyone who still believes that January 6th is sort of this organic uprising, there's no connection between what the FBI did and the Whitmer case in January 6th, even though you have a lot of the same people in charge. I encourage you to reconsider that, because this is shocking, illuminating, and begins to show exactly what this FBI is capable of doing to protect the power center of the Democratic Party.
But just before, we talked to Andrew McCarthy, and I directly asked him how many FBI agents were there January 6th. And he said, oh, I hope that they were there. I hope that they've infiltrated these groups. And I'm with you. I honestly think that a lot of it was a setup.
Well, Andy McCarthy also did not think that this was a case of FBI entrapment. He wrote about that early, so I'm curious to hear what his comments were today. But look, it's not a matter of the FBI informants being on the ground January 6th. It is what they were doing beforehand. We know now, because of Whitmer and a multi-state operation, the FBI is running informants and undercover agents into alleged militia groups, stitching these people together. There are a lot of similarities. There was storming the Capitol, Lansing Capitol, in March and April of 2020 with some of these defendants, led by Dan Chappell, recorded by Dan Chappell. He was taking direction from his FBI handler, he testified. All of a sudden, the Michigan State Police stand down in April, let these men into the building. They have military garb on. They're carrying rifles. They're calling out Gretchen Whitmer's name. They're photographers inside the Capitol building taking pictures. There's chatter about the QRF, Quick Reaction Force, same thing that you see in the Oath Keepers case. There are so many similarities. People cannot turn away from this egregious, abusive entrapment case and what they did to innocent men, and not see the connection between January 6th and when Andy McCarthy says, well, I hope there were FBI agents. Well, what were they doing then?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's not
officials standing there. Why weren't they doing something to allegedly stop the violence instead of provoking it, which the FBI refuses to say did not happen?
Well, yes. I mean, I think McCarthy is saying, I hope they were there to do their job. He's certainly not saying, I hope they were there to entrap people or, you know, aid and abet criminal conduct. And, you know, and even McCarthy, who we just spoke with, as Jeannie mentioned, said he would favor removing the national security mission aspect of the agency's mission from the FBI for this very reason, because they have shown not only are they not good at it, they're perhaps undermining national security with the way they're conducting themselves in cases like this Whitmer kidnapping plot. She is Julie Kelly, senior contributor for AmGreatness, amgreatness.com, author of Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. Julie, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Thank you.
And she joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
The talk going into the weekend was Tiger Woods, talking about the Masters, of course. It was Masters weekend. The talk coming out of it, Scottie Scheffler, the number one player in the world and Masters champion. And here's what he had to say about his victory. Good stuff from this 25-year-old.
My identity isn't a golf score. You know, like Meredith told me this morning, she says, if you win this golf tournament today, if you lose this golf tournament by 10 shots, if you never win another golf tournament again, she goes, I'm still going to love you. You're still going to be the same person. Jesus loves you, and nothing changes. And all I'm trying to do is glorify God, and that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm in this position. And so for me, it's not about a golf score.
You know, I'm going to try that, Jeannie. I'm going to let Jesus take my putter, to borrow from Carrie Underwood, see if that helps improve my game.
His last few putts were a little dicey there.
Yeah, well, they can be when you got a 5-shot lead.
Yeah, that's right.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.